Welcome to Sentence to Paragraph, a podcast on the space between wordcraft and the writer's life. My name is James Stiegel, and I'm joined by my co-hosts, Darylyn Evans and Molly K. Martin. Today, we're talking with science fiction, fantasy, horror, and young adult author, Nina Kariki Hoffman. Nina Kariki Hoffman's The Thread That Binds the Bones won the Bram Stoker Award for first novel. Its follow-up, The Silent Strength of Stones, was a finalist for the Nebula and World Fantasy Awards. In addition to writing, Hoffman teaches, has worked part-time at a bookstore, and does production work for the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. She sings, plays guitar, mandolin, and fiddle, among other instruments, playing regularly at various granges and other venues near her home in Eugene, Oregon. Hi, Nina.
Hi, Nina.
Hi, Nina.
Hey, thank you for being here.
It's a pleasure.
The Silent Strength of Stones is an urban fantasy that takes the reader on two journeys. One from adolescence into adulthood, and the other from our world into a world with magic, all in very subtle and masterful ways. It's not a different world, it's seeing the world in new ways, so the reader feels, I think, an ongoing sense of wonder. The novelette, The Spirit in the Clay, picks up Nick's story as he and Evan are shopping for gifts at the holiday market. Nina, would you read us a sample from Spirit in the Clay?
Sure. What should I buy your sister for Christmas? I asked Evan, my best friend and adopted big brother. For our Christmas shopping trip to Spores Ferry down in the valley, Evan was in his tall, strong human form instead of his more usual white wolf. He wore a white waffle weave shirt and his favorite overalls. He liked overalls because they didn't bind him around the waist. Evan was not big on any kind of bindings. His eyes were the same golden they were when he was a wolf, and his tan was dark. His hair was its perpetual messy shock of white gold. He looked more tidy as a wolf. My family doesn't celebrate Christmas, Nick. Evan glanced around. His hand tightened on my shoulder. The holiday market in the fairgrounds exhibit hall was dense with wandering shoppers and sellers in booths, noisy with conversation and live music, and full of strange smells. Food, scented candles, and herbal mixtures, people. Wolf or human, Evan didn't like large concentrations of people and smells. Okay, I said. You don't celebrate Christmas. I want to buy Willow a present anyway. See anything she'd like? I'd met Willow and Evan last summer. Willow, now my girlfriend, had gone home to Klamath Falls with her scary, witchy family, but we had ways of keeping in touch. Handmade jewelry, pottery, clothes, candles, and blown glass beckoned with gleams, glints, spicy scents, and colors from the shelves of wooden booths. Evan glanced behind us toward the entrance hall and the glass doors beyond. Outside, the day was typical Oregon winter weather, gray and drizzly. He would probably rather be outside than in, though he didn't like getting wet. Bet you could find Megan a present, I said. Megan, he said. She was his summer girlfriend, confused about his dual nature, but inclined to put up with it. She lived here in Spores Ferry, and we lived an hour away up in the Cascades. Evan hadn't seen Megan since last summer, but he exchanged letters with her. Megan celebrates Christmas? You could ask her, or you could just get her a present. She'd probably like that. I'd called Megan that morning and arranged for her to meet us for lunch. I hadn't told Evan yet, and it hadn't occurred to him to do it himself. He was 19 to my 17 in human years, and lots older in wolf years, but about a decade younger in social skills.
Thank you.
I think it was probably Neil Gaiman who was talking about all the edits, and he's like, every time I make an edit and then I send it to my publisher and then I look at the version and I'm like, well, I need to fix 12 more things, and eventually the publisher just takes it away from me and publishes it because it's never going to be good enough.
Yeah, somebody says books are never finished, just abandoned.
Right. Yes. What have you learned in writing?
Well, I can tell you right now two things. One is to do a global search on that, THAT, as word, and pull it all out if you can. Every single one of them you get rid of, get rid of it. And the other thing is, we've been talking about filters, how if I say, I could feel this, it doesn't mean you did feel it. So instead, I would change all that. I could feel the trees. I could feel blah, 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 blah. I could sense. I would say, I felt. I sensed, or the trees were whispering like the wind or something like that. I mean, I would take out that wall between the reader and the actual sensation.
We wanted to make sure we knew how many years you've been writing as well.
Mm-hmm. I started actually selling in 1982.
Well, that's going to require some math, Nina.
I know. That's why I didn't do it.
How many writers does it take to do simple math?
I've got the calculator coming
like,
up here.
What, 36 40,
years.
Is it 36 or 46?
36 years.
36, yeah.
You've been writing stories for more than 30 years. And when we've been talking about, you know, world building for this this year of the podcast, we definitely wanted to talk to you. But in thinking about your work, you know, we had the problem of too much material and too little time. So we thought it'd be a good idea to focus on your Chapel Hollow books, you know, which begin with The Thread That Binds the Bones. But in Silent Strengths of Stones, you know, and then Spirit in the Clay, which you just read from, they're both featuring Nick as the main character. Nick is our entry point into that world. Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting how you balance coming of age and how Nick feels about coming of age and, you know, learning new things about the world with also learning magic and setting up this new world. We were really curious, you know, how in kind of building off our world, how did you refine the world that you started building in the thread? You know, how did you decide how you wanted that world to be different and what were the kind of foundations of that?
I think an early exposure to a lot of Twilight Zone. My favorite episodes are like, it's our world, but it has a little extra, or it's our world, but everybody looks really strange, or just like one twist sideways was my favorite kind of story. There's this whole wainscoting thing that John Clute references in his science fiction encyclopedia, where it's like everything looks the same, but there's strange things going on just behind the scenes. And then there's a twist, so then you might look around your own world and things look different.
We were debating earlier about portal fantasy, and we were talking about, you know, what makes a portal fantasy. And
what is a portal fantasy? Yeah. See,
Molly asked the same question. Okay, so for me, portal fantasy is like there's a portal, right? A normal person, a person is in their normal world.
Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe. Yeah,
exactly. Mm-hmm. And then steps through the portal into the new world, and so that person is your entry point into learning about the new world. And so, you know, with Nick, we have this entry point both from coming of age and dealing with navigating family and navigating the world. And then now we're also going to throw magic into this. Mm. So I think that's something that people can really relate to. But then I think that Nick is also just a really calm guide to help move people through that transition. How did you come to Nick? I know it's been a little while since these were written, right? But was there a strong image or idea in your mind that brought that character to you?
No, that's a great question, but it was 1994, so.
Nick isn't an earlier version of yourself in some way?
No.
Or was he just how you decided to show this world? Like, I need this character to be able to explain this world I want to describe.
No, I don't do worlds. The worlds show up after I know who the characters are.
Okay.
I don't remember a whole lot about writing this book, except that I was really happy. And while I was doing it, I kept driving up into the Cascades and looking around and going off on forest roads and wandering and trying to get what senses were. And I was thinking, why isn't there this town up there? You know, there's Clear Lake up the road, but they have like cabins and there's canoes you can rent and you're not allowed to have a motorboat on it and stuff like that. It's really cool, but why isn't there a resort town on a cool lake up in the Cascades? I didn't find one.
Because nobody logged all the trees down, that's why.
Yeah, but maybe.
Well, and more importantly, why isn't there a resort town with magic?
Yeah, Well, there are. You just haven't been there yet. Or they didn't let you know.
This is true.
I was thinking that historically for me, the year that I was writing this, probably my brother died. And this was a comfort place to go. I hadn't thought this before, but it might have something to do with losing a brother, because there's a strong brotherhood thing going on in the book. But I also felt like after he died, I went 6 months and I couldn't write at all. So I'm not sure I have the historical perspective right.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it could be missing your brother or exploring brotherhood or just, you know, I would like to be in a world where at the end of the book, the family is together and happy and not the people who have gone can come back. And that's one of the things I noticed about going from The Silent Strength to The Spirit in the Clay is that even though Willow and Nick are separated, you know, when The Spirit in the Clay happens, they're, you know, they have this expectation, we're going to be back together. Our family, you know, our relationship is going to come back together.
Yeah.
they had ways of communicating. What was that line?
Yep.
I like that.
Ways of keeping in touch, maybe.
Ways of keeping in touch. That's right.
But I was also, there's also the ghost in that story that not interested in connecting with his own daughter. He's such a jerk. But The other really weird thing about this book is that my oldest brother's name is Nick, and he has nothing to do with Nick in the book, but I just always liked that name. So it's like this guy, Joel Lansdale, he's a wonderful horror writer, and every once in a while, you trip across a story where one of the characters is named Joe, and it's a goofy kid, so you just have to wonder. I didn't really think about it when I was writing the book.
I think especially some names like Joe or Nick or John or something like that, common names. Yeah, it's pretty hard not to find those a lot all over the place.
Yeah, but naming your protagonist your own name is weird, I think.
Well, it's interesting, you know, because you did republish these books recently, right? So how did you have to refamiliarize yourself with the novels, or was there a process to go through as part of the republishing?
Open Road Media asked me if they could republish them. Mm-hmm. And I read through the manuscripts and sent them e-files.
Okay.
When I read the two books, the two stories that feature Nick, the first one being The Silent Strength of Stones, and then I immediately read the novelette, The Spirit in the Clay, which is the one about the holiday market. Yeah. So to me, as a reader, my experience was, you know, here's Nick, and now here's Nick a few months later, you know, at Christmas time. So for you, when you were going back to write the novelette, you're writing about the holiday market. Did you have to reread everything you had read before, or you just kind of looked at those characters and said, oh, there they are?
I think I should have reread everything I wrote because there's a couple of discontinuities between them. Nick was one of my favorite characters. I went through this weird period where I read that A Silent Strength of Stones like two or three times in a row. I don't know. I really liked it. And so I didn't feel like he was distant. The Spirit in the Clay started as a holiday story because we used to have this tradition in Eugene where a bunch of us would get together Christmas Eve and read Christmas Eve ghost stories to each other. And so it was a Christmas Eve ghost story, and I wrote it a few years after Silent Strength of Stones, but I still remember those characters as people I really liked. I probably did reread the book before I wrote it, but I think there was a few years in between.
Something you said makes me really curious. What is it like to go back and read your own work? Just reading, I guess, for pleasure, if you said you read it two or three times right in a row. What is that experience like for you to approach your work like that?
Well, I really do like it.
That's great.
I mean, I'm putting all the cookies in that I would look for in a book, so then I come across them and I'm very happy. They're people I love, and there's some really cool descriptions that I forgot about. The other thing is, like, there's this temporary expert thing where I research something and then I know it really well for long enough to write it, and then I forget it later, and then I go back and I say, how the heck did I do that? How did I know that? Then I'm always impressed. So I do get pleasure from reading my own stuff, for sure.
This might be a bigger question than we could answer in an hour, but what are the cookies that you look for in work? Personally,
there's a bunch of things I don't like, which is like if you ever do NaNoWriMo, you have to you're supposed to write this list of everything you love in books and everything you hate in books, and then if you find yourself veering into hate territory, you should go back and just put what you love in the book. And things I don't like are people who are needlessly mean to each other. I like characters that actually like each other. There's something that Connie Willis calls grace notes, that are little things that are just put in for pure pleasure. They don't actually advance the plot. There's neat settings. There's strong evocation of senses. There's people working to solve problems and figuring out ways that don't occur to you on the first thought. There's cool magical powers. There's a connection with nature, and there's nature connecting back, which might be a pathetic fallacy, but I really like to read about it. I have hope.
Well, speaking of setting, one of the things that I particularly liked about the way that you did world building is you grounded the reader really well, I thought, in the Pacific Northwest, like just so much good sensory detail. So I really felt like it was such a vivid experience for me to read it. And then so when things started to become more magical, I go with you on that journey because I trusted you because the real world was so real that when the magical stuff started happening, I was like, okay, yeah, I believe that too. I think that's one of the things in world building is, you know, how do you pick out those details and how do you find the just exact perfect thing that captures that moment? And when you figure it out, you know, bottle it and definitely sell it to the rest of us.
Well, thanks so much. That's great to hear. Part of what I did was when I first moved to Eugene, I took classes in plant identification and local geology. Like, there was this crazy guy teaching a class through LCC, Lane Community College. I took some classes through LCC where we just went up on the hills and dug up crystals, or he went someplace else and found some agates, or, you know, this guy knew where all these things were out in the landscape. When we go up these Forest Service roads and find stuff, and it was really cool. I don't think they offer that class anymore. But I also took herb classes and plant identification. So I think part of what I like is actually knowing solid information about here. Another thing that happened was a guy, Whitey Lewitt, was doing tree walks. Like every once a month, he would take us out and we'd wander a different neighborhood in Eugene for 2 hours. And he would just tell us what all the trees were and how the, what the soil conditions were. And he could do tree impressions, which you think, how could anybody do this? But he'd do these things where he's like, the tree is drooping because it doesn't have enough water. I don't know. It was just amazing. But he just did some more of these last year after long hiatus. And it was so great to get back to. We were wandering around the campus talking about the exotic trees there. And it was fantastic. So I have a interest in the natural world. And I'm also thinking like a writer, like, what does this smell like? How can I convey it? I think first find out what it is. And then maybe I make a mistake. I don't know, but I do what I can. And then the other thing is you want to pick the significant details, not all the details, which I hope I do. Now, you don't want to load people down with a big stack of details, but three good ones touching on different senses. I think that really helps.
All right. Well, now we can all write award-winning fiction. There you go.
I'm going to track this guy down.
Yeah.
That sounds awesome.
Oh, yeah. So Whitey has a website. Uh-huh. He may list tree walks. I haven't checked lately, but his last name is L-U-E-C-K, Lewick.
I am definitely going to add that to our notes.
People are local. Yeah.
The only problem is that I think he stopped because the tree walks got so unwieldy because he's having 50 or 60 people to shepherd around. And so I think that might be one of the reasons why he stopped. And so he's keeping it on the down low about starting them again, but he was still attracting huge crowds. So.
Nah, you heard it here first, folks. Tree walks.
I shouldn't have put his name in the...
We'll just beep it out. Beep. Oh, dear. Everyone's going to know who this guy is.
Yeah. Oh, dear. But no, they're wonderful. He's just great. He's an urban forester.
Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of that blending of folklore and reality, maybe specifically to the Eugene area. Maybe it's just the culture. Maybe it's just the Pacific Northwest. But that was another aspect of the story that I really enjoyed is there seemed like there was, I don't know if you just invented all of the sort of the traditions and the folklore of the story, or if you took stuff that was already part of the culture and interwove it in the story. Can you talk a little bit about the magical elements of your story and where those came from?
I had these big pieces of paper with the family trees and everybody was color coded by which element. And I used to have that on the office wall and I don't know where it is and I wish I could find it again, you know, and then they had little symbols for, I had all this stacks of paper about who did what. So the magic part started in thread for this particular set of books, because I think the magic varies from one series to another. I try and make it not the same across all of them. I think a lot of fantasy reading influenced me. Can't pinpoint exactly, you know, except I read a whole lot of fantasy.
I don't know which Potter you were envisioning in Spirit in the Clay, but there is a Potter at the holiday market that I immediately thought of. Because for us personally, so when we were teaching my son to wash dishes, we had a bunch of plates from this Potter who only comes out to the holiday fair. Uh-huh. And my son kept breaking the plates. And it was like we had to go buy, you know, cheap plates so if they got broken, it wasn't, you know, as big a deal.
Yeah.
But it just made me feel, and this is something I was kind of curious about, because I've read like those details I thought worked really well for me when I've kind of read other things that were sort of based in an area I know that didn't work as well. And I'm not sure how conscious it was or if it's something you were thinking about. It was like the blend between a generic detail and a specific detail, you know, with something like the Potter or why you chose pottery and the holiday market. That felt like folklore to me. I don't know how to really describe it. Like if I was to, like, it was almost like creating a story around this Potter at the holiday market that I've grown up with that I think it'd be really fun having read this story to, like, you know, nudge somebody the next time we're there and be like, hey, you know, that's so haunted, right? And start start this whole tradition. Like, you just freaked my son out. Like, you broke the plate. He's going to come get you. I don't know. That felt like folklore. I don't know. Molly, is that kind of what you're thinking of? Or
yeah. I think, James, you captured it very well. It's not necessarily folklore per se, but it has that feeling of folklore. Like, to me, it evokes that there's this whole world of traditions and stories and these other characters and magical powers that, you know, if we could just look at it right, we would all be able to see it.
Yeah, well, that's very cool. Yeah, that's what I hope. You never know how people are going to receive what you're doing, but that's what I would like in a response. The pottery thing, it's just like there's so many great potters at Holiday Market, and I wanted to put a ghost there somehow, but I get a cup from this guy every year. When I was a kid, my parents gave us art lessons, all different kinds of art lessons, and we actually had pottery lessons from a famous potter in Santa Barbara named Oscar Bucher, and so I had some experience actually throwing pots, so that helped a little bit, even though it was a long time ago. As far as details of his work, I think I pretty much invented that. Although if I saw those pots, it would be cool. And I like that one where there's like fossils and stuff on it. And I was looking for who would I put if I had a ghost at Holiday Market, which was the prompt I came up with, where would it come from? I have a friend who actually works the market. His name is Dan Young, and he sells these fabulous tiles that have angels and fairies and green men and all kinds of things like that. And he's fun to talk to. But I don't actually know his process. I do wander through the Holiday Market every year, so it felt like a great place to set something.
It's definitely that kind of place.
Yeah.
I want to keep going on the kind of that sense of almost a folktale or folklore feel to these, but from a different angle. And I think where I really felt that sense was from, and I know we're not technically talking about it today, but the book, The Thread That Binds the Bone, I feel like that definitely had that sense of that almost folklore feel. This is, you know, the family that they have all of these ghosts that have, and other presences that have come with them. But also, like, there's this deep history in the magical family. From, you know, there's some old world stuff and, oh, these are the rings that have been missing for 300 years. But also you have a situation where there's a town of locals who are non-magical people that are bound to this, to the Chapel Hollow family. And that's kind of that folklore-esque feeling of that, you know, like they kind of give, you know, tithings or some kind of pledges or something, and then the magical folk do boons for them and whatnot, although that relationship has broken down by the time we get to Thread That Binds the Bone. But also I think that, and this continues into, or I guess through the other books, but into Silent Strength of Stones, where there is the, you know, like, so there's the Chapel Hollow family, but this is a different clan of the family. We're looking at folks, Willow and her family are different from a different clan. And I really love how, and they have different rules. I really love how they have, like, there's this deep sense of this interconnected community, but there are kind of different rules and different aspects to that. And all of this long explanation is leading to kind of thinking about, like, how deep did you think about this world when you were creating it? And how like, are you a discovery writer? Did you plan this? It sounds like you did. You had some charts and whatnot. Do you keep adding to that, or did you have it all mapped out before you really started in these books?
No, I'm totally a discovery writer, and I just hope things show up, and they often do. It's very fun. I mean, I had to do some graphing and stuff like that just to keep track of everybody. As far as what the magic can do and how it works, it appears in the process of the writing for me. And I'm showing you the tip of the iceberg, and there's no rest of the iceberg until I actually go back and explore it maybe and find out more. And that's something I've been afraid to say for a long time, but I feel like it's in there somewhere, and it just comes out. There's a Stephen King thing from his book on writing where he thinks there's like the fossilized form of the book already. You just have to get it out. It's the whole thing is there. And I thought that's how it works for me pretty much. I think it's all there and then it appears.
Did you plan always to write a bunch of different novels in this world, or how did you conceive that?
Yeah, it wasn't a plan.
What keeps bringing you back?
Well, I love it. And the other thing that I don't think people know is that chronologically, Silent Strength of Stones happened first, and Thread That Binds the Bones came second. In Silent Strength of Stones, Willow talks about a prophecy that somebody's going to bring this guy who's a slave back to the place and everything will get better. And that's what happens in Thread That Binds the Bones. But the other thing was, like, I really love reading series where there's somebody that you get comfortable with and you want to read more about them and then you want to go see what happens to them next. And I thought maybe I could do that, but I haven't managed to very well. So I just wanted standalones.
I think that's one of the things that I enjoyed about it is you can kind of read them in either order, and both of, you know, either Thread That Binds the Bones or Silent Strength of Stones, you can read them in either order. Mm-hmm. And both of them enrich the other, but it didn't feel like either one was sort of necessary, like you have to read this one first.
Oh, good.
My question for that is, you know, since it wasn't a planned series, how do you compress the world building? You know, you wrote one first and then you wrote the other one.
Yeah.
How did you take the things that you had kind of already set down, like this is how the world is in the first book that you had written, and get it into the second book without saying, okay, now I have to go through this whole list of exposition of here's everything that people already know? Because I didn't feel like there was a bunch of that on the page. So again, bottle that, sell it to the rest of us. Tell us how you did it.
Well, I think one other thing is viewpoint character. Okay, so Nick doesn't know anything about any of this stuff until it comes into his life. So he's learning it. The reader can learn it along with him. And then I only have to tell you as much as is necessary for that story. Because they're not sequential, really, you only need to know enough for one. There's another book called Spirits That Walk in Shadow that's about one of the people in Chapel Hollow going away to college in Sporus Ferry, which is my analog for Eugene. And it's just like, well, she's a really cool character. I'm going to see what happens when she goes away to college.
I get more the impression that you're kind of chronicling like this whole area than necessarily like trying to tell a, like, yeah, you know, I have these seven plot points and I've got to hit them all. It's more like, here's this world and let me show you, you know, you can have this little window onto this person's life. And now here's another little window and, you know, oh, that was pretty interesting. Let's follow it a little bit more.
Yeah, that's it. That's more like it.
Well, this kind of ties into a question I have, but I'm not sure how else to shoehorn this in, but do you think of yourself as a short story writer or a novelist? Or is it more where the story leads you?
I do both.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not either or, although I've been doing short stories for the past few years, mostly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I like both forms.
Okay.
What are some of your obsessions in the short stories? Because you spend so much time doing that. And as you said, the last several years, you've really been focused on short stories. And is it, the count I have is that you're over 200 short stories. Is that, sure. Is that right? Or is it a little higher than that?
Let me see. I have this thing here.
You know, these are really great writer problems to have when you've written so many short stories that you're like, I just don't know.
So this is my like list, and it looks like the most recent one is coming out. One of the stories I had in FNSF is going to be in the year's best fantasy and science fiction.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's awesome. So that's the most recent sale I have. It's number 336.
336? What?
Now, some of those are books, some of them are stories, some of them are reprints. So it's not all new stuff, but yeah. Yeah, but then I've been working at it for a long time.
Wow. So sorry, that little digression there on my part. Since you've been focused on short stories, what do you kind of have an obsession there or a particular focus, or is it something that just simply allows you to range widely? How do you approach the short stories?
Sometimes there's an anthology open that I was trying to write for. Ellen Datlow was doing a dark horror anthology, and I wrote a story for that that she didn't actually buy, and then I have to go fix it and try and sell it someplace else. Sometimes we do a writing exercise, and I get started on something I think is very cool. The story I'm working on right now, I'm doing a rewrite of a story I wrote at the Science Fiction Fantasy Workshop weekend that was a couple years ago, maybe. I have this book I'm calling a story cookbook where I have all these things you can roll up with dice. And I think you've seen that, Darlene, right? Or you've seen some of those roll. So you roll some dice and get characters, or you roll dice and get the skeleton of a plot and then see what happens. I think my theory is you can take any three things, and your mind will start spinning a story around them. So stories come from all over the place, and sometimes it's from like, oh, there's an open anthology I could write for. And sometimes it's just, I need to start something now. Not sure about obsessions, really.
It sounds like there's a bit of discipline there. Like you just tell yourself, I need to start a story, it's time, and you sit down and do it. Is that the case?
That's the dream case. I'm in a really peculiar situation where I write in coffee shops and I don't write at home. I try to, but I got allergic to it about 10 years ago. So first I have to get to the coffee shop and then I have to eat something and then I have to focus. So we do Eric Witchie's parallel play sessions at the coffee shops where 45 minutes of writing and 15 minutes of chat and then 45 minutes of writing. I try to be disciplined and get stuff done during those 45 minutes.
I'm just over here laughing and smiling because I think I have the same kind of routine. Is just, I'm like, well, I have to have my 2 hours of procrastination first before I can start writing, obviously.
Yeah.
I can't just sit down and write. That would be insane.
It's sort of, you got to have your ritual. I think they talk about this in No Plot, No Problem, the Bible of NaNoWriMo too.
Some of the events of The Silent Strength are quite dark in the sense that they deal with a family that can be quite manipulative, if not downright evil. Yet Nick has an almost innocent outlook on the world as he accepts many things, such as the existence of magic, without being judgmental or frightened. Can you comment on how you used Nick's point of view to introduce the reader to the world through the lens of his coming-of-age story?
Yeah, the darkness, that spooks me, but it seems like that's what stories call for now. I tried writing a story where everybody was happy and nobody was interested, you know? We're really, one of my mentors, Algis Budras, said people read for survival information. And I just think about that all the time. I think he said, you know, you read the back of a cereal box, you're looking for survival information. And one of the things that I read a lot of books for, and I read tons of books, was looking for answers to how to handle conflict in my own life. And even if it's not a direct answer, I would get information that served me. You have to address the darkness and show people surviving it, but dealing with it in ways that might help people figure it out how to deal with what they're dealing with. I mean, it's not like I go into this thinking, oh, I'm going to give somebody a lesson or something like that. But just afterthoughts is that maybe somebody can get something valuable from this.
So no, I think that's really powerful, though. That's Nick is very calm in how he kind of sorts through these things. I mean, I think Spirit in the Clay really kind of encapsulates that, actually. Like the whole time I kind of expected him to freak out, but he's very calm in himself. And in a way, it's a story about how to have good boundaries.
He didn't have them initially. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think there was the line about, well, you were open to it. And so it pushed its way in, I think, or there was something to that extent. And so in a way, as again, extending that coming of age kind of thing, that yes, you can be open to the world, but you also have to accept that somebody's going to try and push their way into your life. And how do you establish that boundary?
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, was that conscious or was that just something that came within Nick?
Yeah, it's not like I set out to tell a particular story that's going to teach you something.
Yeah.
So it came from the character. But I think that is, I really like the way you said that, because I think that that's a dilemma that a lot of people face, is how do I keep myself safe and still be open? And I think for him, that was a big issue, even though he had a lot of help. And in Silent Strength of Stones, he does freak out a few times and then Evan just like calms him down magically.
Yeah.
But also that's been ever since I started writing, people are always like, why aren't these people more upset about this fabulous thing that's happening? And I said, I just want to get past that and move on to the good stuff. I don't want to stop and have them freak out. I think that's a thing. That's definitely a thing, that I don't have them pulling back or freaking out as much as they probably would if it actually happened. I think Kristen in the book had a freak out and Nick just sort of hypnotized her out of it. But what about Megan? She was okay. Suddenly she's got a boyfriend who's a werewolf.
Well, it's actually sort of Nick's attitude and the way he kind of not necessarily accepts, but he just receives all of this, you know, the fact that there is magic in the world was one of the things that I really thought did a lot to counteract some of the, you know, darker themes, if you will, in the book. You know, you've got some people doing some pretty questionable things, but then you've also got these characters who they're not coming down on anybody. They're not like judging it or saying, you know, you're wrong, you're bad, I'm never going to talk to you again. They're not dealing in absolutes. They're just kind of open to the world. And, you know, especially nowadays, not to bring politics into it because we dare not, but you have a world that's so divided where people just don't want to hear anything from anybody else. So I don't know. That's one of the things I love so much about him is he's like, okay, this is totally new and I'm okay with that.
That's great. Thanks. Yeah. That's really neat.
Well, my question before we run out of time. So in the course of these 300 stories or 336 stories, I'm sorry, and novels, how do you feel that this could be, again, too big for an hour, but how do you feel the business of writing has changed in the course of those stories of working as a writer? Does it feel significantly different to you, like even in the last 10 to 15 years as opposed to when you started?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, of course, the electronic stuff happened, and that was not a factor when I first started. It was all print media. And then self-publishing as well. That's a big option. So that you can bypass the editorial process. And I'm not sure that's good, although a lot of stuff gets published. Some of it's interesting, but then the field is denser and people have a hard time finding things. I think everything has shifted around.
How has it changed for you as a writer, like the business side of writing? And one of the questions we usually ask is, what is that question? how is it to be author Nina Creaky Hoffman versus the writing life of Nina Creaky Hoffman? And particularly that, like thinking about those businessy things, like does it feel like there are more things on your plate versus, you know, or have some things gotten easier or those kinds of things?
Well, I have to say it's a lot easier to send things electronically than to get the manila envelope and have the return postage on the inside manila envelope and then weigh everything and make sure you've got enough postage and all that and go to the post office. Electronic submission is cool. I really like it.
If I could add to Derlin's question, Nina, I've always had a real sense that you have a really good understanding of marketability and what it, you know, even from like, hey, I'm going to write a story with the intention of selling it to this market.
Mm.
But you still, to me, balance a really, your artistic sense is still on point. Like you can write something that is aimed at a market and it's still art. And that is an art to me. And I've always been curious how, like, is that difficult? Is that something you've had to spend a lot of time developing or just looking for the art in something that's marketable? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I can tell you that I had a couple of different training grounds, which were great. Marty Greenberg used to have a company called Technobooks, and he would put out a whole bunch of DAW anthologies every month. And so he had a cadre of under editors who were saying, here's the theme, single white vampire, supernaturals find love among the classifieds. And then it was really exciting because you'd say, okay, I can write that. And then you'd write it. And then he would send the contract and the check in the same envelope 2 weeks after you sent the story in, which was not industry standard at that point. It used to be, you know, you'd sell the story, you'd get the contract, you'd sign the contract, you might get paid 6 or 8 months later. You didn't know. But Marty Greenberg, oh my God, it was just great. So a bunch of us, Dean Wesley Smith, Christine Catherine Rush, Ray Vuksovich, me, I don't know if Jerry Ilton was in on this, but a bunch of us Eugene writers, we were all like writing for these anthologies and making money to pay the electricity. It was awesome. And so that, I guess there was a heyday for that during the 90s and early 2000s. And so we knew we could make money. And it was just, it's like finding the thing to put inside the sonnet. You take the form and then you just do something as cool as you can with it. And it was great. It was so fun. But he died and the market changed. And so that's doesn't happen as much anymore, but it was a good training ground. And then I also had this experience where I was working with Parachute Press, writing Ghosts of Fear Street, which was an R.L. Stine thing. It was so fun. We were writing middle school books for, it wasn't Goosebumps because, you know, he had two or three things going on at the same time. His wife, Jane, was the head of of Parachute and she would just, have all these different projects, but he built a world, Fear Street. And then we got to write these kids books set in it. And, it was like, a book by committee, but the committee was so awesome. I would, you know, I'd send in, here's a one paragraph idea about this kid body switching. And then they'd say, okay, tweak it this way. And then I'd send that back and then we'd work on the outline. But then I'd get to write it and I'd get to stick all this stuff in from things I was scared of when I was a kid or whatever. Another thing I did was Sweet Valley Junior High. I did one of those books. It was so fun because it was like, it's set in California where I grew up. And I could stick in the Natural History Museum from my childhood. And it had these four different viewpoints, a Korean girl, a Hispanic boy, the Wakefield twins and stuff like that. And so we had this multicultural cast and I could think about that. And they each had their own voice. And it was really fun. So I had some work for hire projects where I got a chance to be cool in somebody else's universe. It was really fun. Is that an answer? I don't know.
I think it is. Look for the coolest thing you can do within the bounds you're given. That sounds
right.
Like,
or yeah. Maybe stretch them a little bit.
Yeah.
But don't, that's one of the things about writing for anthologies is you don't want to twist it all up so that it doesn't actually fit. You do need to actually address the theme because that's what the book is about. But you don't want to be doing what everybody else is doing, which I don't think we ever did, but it was really cool. It was a fun era.
You just mentioned working with a bunch of different writers here in Eugene. And I know for a long time there, well, it seems like even still, there's quite a cadre of pretty amazing sci-fi fantasy writers and other writers. Could you talk about working with them and maybe also talk about, are you in a writing group now? I know you were part of Wordos for a long time. Are you?
Yeah, I still am. Yeah.
Great. Could you talk a little bit about all of that?
Yeah. When I first started writing, I lived in a bookstore in Moscow, Idaho, or when I first started writing for publication, there was this bookstore downstairs and I had the upstairs apartment and then Dean Wesley Smith, who ran the bookstore, lived in the basement. And we had a workshop in Moscow. It was called the Moscow Mafia, eventually. And it was really cool. Or Writer's Block with just BLOC. So we started doing that. And then Dean and I applied to and got accepted in Clarion in 1982. So we went to Clarion together. He met Christine Catherine Rush at the first Writers of the Future workshop in Taos, New Mexico in 1986, I think. And then they looked around for a place to live and they ended up settling in Eugene. And so then they would just invite other people to come move to Eugene and be part of the writers group. And that's how Jerry and Kathy Oltian came here. We had a lot of people who either lived here or just came to be with us and it was awesome. And then the workshop went through a bunch of changes in the 90s and Dean and Chris moved off to Lincoln City. But there continues to be a lively group of people. I don't know. It's like, what am I? I'm in this workshop for 30 years. And I don't always workshop stuff, although I started to do it again because they're really good critics. But like I'm on the old codger who tries to tell them things now. And there's been a big turnover. Like James was in this workshop for a while. Mm-hmm. It was fun having you there. But yeah, a whole bunch of us were starting out at the same time and we came up at the same time. Dean and Chris went on to publish lots more than I do because they have a much better work ethic. And they teach a lot, too, on the coast. They run coast workshops. And they have a lot of information. I think a lot of this started because Dean and I were living in Moscow, Idaho, and we did drive 500 miles to Eugene to go to Kate Wilhelm and Damon Knight's once-a-month workshop at their house. I'm sorry, I'm backtracking now. But so we would do that. We'd make that drive. We'd be talking about riding all the way there and back. Sometimes we'd just stay at their house, even though it was full of cigarette smoke. but it was awesome. And that's because we had the Clarion connection. They were always the last two to teach at Clarion. And they always invited anybody who had been to Clarion to come to their workshop. And so our first writing association with Eugene was going to that workshop. And it was really a learning experience. And we met a lot of great people that way. But also, it just seemed like there's something in the water. People would say this, oh, why are there so many science fiction writers in Eugene? Ooh, I think it's just because Dean and Chris said, hey, move here and be in our workshop. I'm not sure. No, but Damon and Kate really started that tradition a long time before that.
That's amazing. I love hearing that story. So what about working with writers now? Are there some writers who inspire you? Or as you mentioned, you're now the old codger teaching them. Well, and you teach here, you teach for the local writing, the local community college. You teach a class each year.
Yeah, I teach a short stories class through LCC. And that's really fun. I do work with word crafters, which I'm really happy about. We're doing the Science Fiction and Fantasy Weekend in April. I used to work with Louisa Lindsay Sprouse, who did the Young Writers Association. I'd meet with teen writers after school once a week, and I'd just bring in prompts, and we'd all write stuff, and it was really fun. And some of those kids have gone on to join Wordos and are still writing. Yeah, I don't think I am the old codger in the workshop, but it's not that I'm teaching them stuff, although I'm complaining about things. They're all... They're very smart, and they're right on about things. They're critiquing things that I don't notice, so I think they're awesome. Yeah, but I feel like outreach is good. I'm a judge at the Writers of the Future contest, so I get to go down there in April and talk to the new winners. And I'm like, yeah, I'll give them a story cookbook, which I just, you know, that's my thing, to roll things up. I like that part.
Yeah. Sounds amazing.
Well, it seems like there's a lot of energy from that for you, like that relationship with new writers. And I mean, I've gotten so much inspiration from you, and I see other people getting the same thing. And it just, you know, we talk, you know, thinking about like these centers of energy in Eugene in particular, and I see you as central to that in Eugene.
Ooh.
Well, I'm just thinking about like the emails you send out every day about writing. Like even though I have to work, I know that Nina is sparking writing somewhere in town right now. You know, it's 4:00. Nina's at, Starbucks, and I'm wishing I could be there, but I can't, but I know there are people that are there, that are writing right now. And, you know, that's really cool to me. So, and I know it's not the kind of thing that it takes energy to do that, you know, it takes effort, and you're consistent about that. So it's always been really inspirational to me.
Oh, these are like the writing dates emails.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cause it's for me, it's a lot of fun to have company on these things, you know? Yeah, it's fun to sit with a bunch of writers. I did this last night at the new Starbucks out by Valley River. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was 4 of us there. That was fun.
So I think our takeaway here is move to Eugene and you can go out right. And write with Nina at the local cafe.
Find a place while you can because the rent's going up.
Yeah.
Well, Molly's going to start it up on the East Coast when she can. So.
Yeah, yeah.
We'll just call it Eugene friends. East.
Yeah.
Make some writing friends and just go write with them.
Nina, it's so fun talking to you, and I think we could go on for hours and hours, but we probably want to let you go sometime today. But before we do, we like to end each interview with a little spot of inspiration for writers striving to master their craft. Is there a little last piece of wisdom you would like to leave our writers with? The best piece of advice you've ever received, a quote that inspires you, a song or a slam poem if you're so inspired?
I just think keep learning new things. I love taking classes and finding out about something else. Keep reading, keep watching movies. It all goes into the mix. It all gets transformed in your brain and then comes out as something magical. So just be open to all the cool stuff that's out there.
Wonderful. All right. How can our listeners and adoring fans find you?
Well, I'm on Facebook. I don't do the Twitter. I just do the Facebook.
All right. Sounds great. So that would be as Nina Creaky Hoffman?
Yes.
Awesome. All right. Thanks so much, Nina, for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Nina.
Thanks, okay. Nina.
Yep. Bye-bye.
Bye.